And you don't shake hands so much in India. It's much more bowing. And in real traditional, old-fashioned society, you bow real low to somebody who's a big wheel or an older person or something like that. But we don't go into that. And the young people don't either. They don't pay so much attention to the old customs as the old people. Some people bow right down to the ground, you know, and go through almost this kissing your feet kind of thing. Did you want me to begin right off?
Yes, right. Any
well,
time
I gotta get my glasses on. Because I wrote some things down.
I think everybody would like to know if your sari has any particular origin, where it comes from. Is it general to the whole continent?
No, this is really the kind of dress that the ladies wear all over India. And all it is a 6 yards of cloth. That's what took me so long in this dressing room. Tell you, I said the only thing Indian I had with me was this Indian sari. And then I put it on. So you have to, you have on a petticoat underneath. It can be any color, but this is just plain white. It's got a tight string in the drawers. Then you start with the other end of the sari. You start tucking it around and around and around and around and around. And then you leave a little surplus and throw this over your shoulder, and then you take all the surplus and go like this and make that pleating thing and tuck it in. There are no pins, and there's nothing up my sleeve, it just stays on.
Have you ever known of an accident with one of these? I can imagine
yes.
That somebody...
I was out walking in the country with some Indian ladies one day, and the lady stumbled, and you know, caught her toe in it like that, it began to unravel. But for them, it's nothing because they are so skillful in getting back together again. And then the little blouse is something this is American material, but the Indian women would mostly wear a hand-woven cotton. In fact, most Indian women would not wear a silk, sorry. This is silk. They'd wear cotton. The more wealthy Indian women also wear cotton because it has great social significance. During the days when they were fighting for freedom, one of their great symbols of rebellion against the British was to spin the cotton and weave their own cotton so they wouldn't have to buy the British-made goods. You remember you've gone through all that? I guess you have. And so now it's quite, well, I guess you'd say it's quite stylish for some of the wealthier women to wear what they call cutting, which means home-woven, hand-woven cotton cloth. And it's beautiful, too. But then a lot of people wear silk because it's a little more snappy. And it's true that there are a lot of machine-made things coming into Delhi, into all the cities of India. And this is good too. They can't exist on a hand economy forever. But the symbolic part of the hand-woven cotton still sticks. I don't want to repeat everything that you all have talked about, but I just so I'll know that you know the same things I do, I'll just review what I was thinking when I was thinking about this. Because I know you know it, but each time when I start to talk about India, now it's 1963, I have to remind myself that it was only 1947 that they became independent. So it's really not a very long time that India has existed as a free, unified nation. And so all of these things, such as spinning cotton and weaving cotton cloth, which may seem sort of insignificant to us, why not have them all machine-made? They are important to the Indian people because the still is a symbol of their great national spirit. Now, I agree, you just, anybody stop, you stop me if I start saying a whole lot about things that, because I thought I wouldn't do too much on the facts of Indian history. That I know you can get it. If you haven't got it yet, there are loads more things to read and you'll enjoy it. And anyway, we don't have too much time here today. But the just those basic facts about India, that she is an old civilization. This I'm sure you went through. The earliest things are 2000 to 4000 BC. And this civilization has been going on for centuries and centuries and centuries, but it's only since 1947 that India has existed as a modern, independent nation and a democracy. That, you know, she really is one of the few newly independent countries of Asia or Africa that's had real countrywide elections, just like we have. The people go to the polls. Everybody can vote. They're much better than we. When they gave people the vote, they gave it to the women right away, along with the men. They didn't have to wait as we did. Perhaps in your American history, you must have learned about how the women had to fight, even in this century, to get the vote for themselves. I think another thing to remember, and I just want to remind you so that I'll not hear things with the same thing I am, is that when you're talking about India and the old civilization, all her old history, you're really talking about that whole subcontinent. And you just can't think of India without thinking of Pakistan. And sometimes you get these days. You want to ask something?
No, I'm just going to go with this.
Oh, well, no, you had a question you wanted to ask, Howard.
I did?
Didn't you? You said something. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay. I'm sorry.
You have music lessons.
Sure. You have to think of India and Pakistan together. Nowadays, you read in the newspapers, you hear on the radio, all the friction that there seems to be between these two countries, and you feel as if they must be very separate, but actually they're the same people and have the same background and could easily get along together. What did you want to ask?
To go to Pakistan also?
Sure, but not to live. I mean, I really didn't live in India. I was only there for 2 years, but I've been to Pakistan several times. Yeah?
You've been to Kashmir?
Yeah, oh, it's beautiful. And that's the kind of thing you hear about, is all the friction and discussion about who has the right to Kashmir. But really the two nations, you can see how they belong together. And the fact that, you know, you've been all through this. West Pakistan is way over to the west, and East Pakistan is way over to the right, and they don't have any way of connecting with each other. Yeah?
Did you ever visit Nepal?
Yes.
Could you explain your trip there a little?
Oh, I'd love to.
I think what they're all very interested, we're doing a project on Indian villages.
Oh,
they
yes.
They all have different areas that they are trying to find as much out about as
yeah.
they can. What the houses look like, what
uh-huh.
kind of farms, and how big, and what they grow, and so forth. And this information is not very easy to come by, so
well,
we're kind of looking for you as an expert.
I see. Well, I'm trying to think of what Nepal book I know that would be the best. But anyway, Nepal, I know where it is and everything and how hard it is to get to. It's becoming much, much more accessible. A few years ago, they didn't want anybody to come in. But in 1952, when my husband was ambassador to India, he was also ambassador to Nepal. And we went in the hard way, for the fun of it, really. We went in on horseback up over the high mountains and down into the Kathmandu Valley. Well, the villages are, it's real hill country. That's an understatement, I may say, because it's the Himalayas. And you're looking right over at Mount Everest and all these other snow-covered mountains. The villages look a lot like was going to mention a place you probably don't know, but the mountainous country of Peru. Lots of wood. I don't know why that is, but they're not a bit like the Indian villages or the villages of the plains. They don't use mud and stone. They use a lot of wood. And they have overhanging balconies. I'm trying to think of some place in the United States that's like, well, it's kind of like, I suppose, up in the Adirondacks, where the people go skiing and that kind of. It's got a real, real... Oh my, yes. You know the Peace Corps have some volunteers in Nepal now. Did you know that? Well, this to us is very interesting because in 1952 when we went there, there were very, very few schools, and the boys and girls of wealthy parents went to India to school, or even went to Great Britain or the United States or something. Now, we had a letter the other day from a friend of ours who's a Peace Corps volunteer, and he's working in a village named Poker that my husband flew into in 1952, and they had never seen a wheel. Now, this is really true. They hadn't seen a wheel until about 1951 when the first airplanes came in. Now, the reason for that is that a wheel is really useless. You know, if you're going up and down a hill, you can't pedal a bicycle, or a donkey can't drag a cart or anything. And the people carry all these tremendous burdens on their backs. You've seen pictures with them, they have these, it's not the head load that the nice, pretty, you know, how nice it makes a woman look to carry a load on her head, or a man too, they stand so straight. But the Nepalese have a band across their head and they're bent over like these huge, heavy burdens on their back. And the villages are, I suppose they're quite a lot like India, as India was a few years ago, in the lack of schooling, in the lack of doctors and nurses and all that, but that's coming. And the Peace Corps are they going to make quite a little difference in a small country. A few volunteers doing teaching like that can make a big difference. Yeah?
When you went there, was there a lot of education for women?
For women? Well, there was a girls' school, which I went to, and no, there wasn't. And in any developing country, this is just automatic that when they begin to expand their schools and get more schools, the first people to get the education are the boys, and the girls come next. Sorry to say. Yeah?
Well, what's the elevation of the real high villages in the Himalayas?
Now you can find that in a report. This never sticks in my head. Now my husband is absolutely wonderful on facts, and I never can remember them. He gets annoyed. It's hard for me to learn them too. Why don't you learn them? I just know it's awfully high. And, no, isn't Everest
24,000? Yes.
29. Well, I suppose the areas that we went over to get down into Kathmandu might have been as high as 12 or 14. That's awful high. Yeah?
Have you ever been on a houseboat?
In Kashmir? Yes. This must be the Kashmir student.
Oh, we have several, but we're doing Pakistan and Bhutan, Nepal, Kashmir. And then we'd love to know a little bit about the Indian villages, because this is the thing that there just isn't any information for us. How do they grow? They grow rice in Nepal before we leave Nepal.
Oh, yes, they do. But that's fascinating. I'm not a good agriculturalist, but this is so obvious that you, as we were riding in, it's all hilly. There's no flat land until you get down to the bottom of the valley. So the rice fields are all terraced. Just think of the work to make a little area about as big as across the corner of this room. but it has to be irrigated. And as you ride along, you'd see these like aqueducts, and they're very small wooden ducts of water. And then the farmers would draw them all for this field and that field, and then they go on down the hill. It's very difficult, but they do throw them right. Yeah.
Was it hard to communicate?
To talk with them?
Yeah.
Well, very hard for me, but that is not their fault. I don't speak Nepali. I can speak a little Hindi, and Nepali is very much like it. At the time we were there, the king, the man who was king before the present king, was alive, and he had two wives, and it was, you know, it was a formal occasion. My husband was the ambassador, and so we were supposed to talk. And the women are not socially very free, and so they kind of gather over in one corner, and I would attempt to talk with them, and I found that they did speak a little Hindi, and I struggled and struggled with one of these wives in Hindi. And all of a sudden, her son came up, and she said in English, "I want you to meet my son." I said, "All right, I'm through crying in Hindi or anything else." But otherwise, I think the question could be that it is still hard to communicate, even when you know the language, because of such a very different experience that these women would have had and what I would have had. Well, just to tell you, the two queens, known as senior and junior queen, were sisters. And the king married one when she was 14, and married the other when she was about that age, too. And this kind of threw me, because I would, you know, naturally try to work up a conversation, and I start to talk about my children. And I had so few children, it seemed, in comparison, when he added the two queens together, they had quite a lot. Now, the difference in custom and background makes it hard sometimes to communicate. Yeah.
So, do you know if the schools in India were the same grade level as the United States or the lower?
No, they're not. I know that because our children went to school in Delhi, which is the capital of India, and not only the grades are a little different at the when you approach a university or college, but more than that, what they do in the grades and their progress is quite different. Our children were behind in mathematics and science. They were so far behind in mathematics they couldn't follow it in the, you know, see, one, our son was 11, and I guess he was going into sixth grade. So that's about right. And he had been doing fine at home, everything was okay. But when he got to the school in Delhi, he just couldn't keep up with the class at all. They were doing algebra and really terribly advanced things that they weren't doing at all in his school in Connecticut.
Was there any difference in the method of teaching math, or was it just that you had done it faster?
It was, well, let me explain first. This is not perhaps a typical Indian school as of today. This is an English-type school, of which there are a great many still in India. The new school of India is a much more, it's much more related to the life of the average Indian child. An awful lot of these schools that were left over after the British left were oriented to the British. And I remember when we first arrived, and I had thought that our children were going to get such a lot out of being in India. And great, they were going to a school with all the other Indian children. And one of the first things that our son had to do in his, what it was called, class, geography, I think, was to draw a map of the harbor at Bristol, England. And this was not my idea of learning about India, and indeed it wasn't. But the content of the school curriculum since independence has been changing all the time to include a lot more about Indian history and Indian life. Then when you get to the, after you finish seven grades, your eighth grade is the end of pre-college. But then you have one more year that's just entirely devoted to getting into college. I forgot what they call it. And then you take the, what used to be called the Cambridge exam. And I want you to really think about this. Indians should be taking the Cambridge exam. They don't do it anymore. They have their own Indian educational system examination. But everything was oriented to Great Britain for so many years that it took them a while to get away from it.
Mm-hmm. How many languages itself are there in India?
There are 14 major languages. Really spoken by as many people as, say, speak French or German or Italian. And it, that's an awfully good thing to ask and to think about. When you think of India, you just think of India as a nation. She has a delegation in the United Nations. She's one country. It's really like the United States of Europe would be, if we ever could have such a thing as the United States of Europe. The culture of the people in South India is totally different and separate from the culture of the people of North India. These languages are not much understood between each other. They have one national language, so proclaimed at the time of independence, called Hindi. And it's H-I-N-D-I is the official national language. But the Constitution stated that for a period of, I don't know how many years, 10 to 20 years, they could use interchangeably English and Hindi as official languages. But then these other people, first, if you suppose you're going to school in Kashmir, you naturally, you speak Kashmiri. So you go to first grade and second grade of school. Everything you learn in Kashmiri. All the time that you are learning your reading and writing and arithmetic and history and art and so on in Kashmiri, you are, by law, every school has to teach all the children Hindi. So you start very early learning the Indian national language. And you learn it quite well and quickly. By the time you get to secondary school, you have to also learn English, because so many of the higher grade textbooks, that is more advanced textbooks, are in English, and they haven't had time to translate them into Hindi, and hopefully they never will. You know, I don't know if you really want to discuss this language thing, but it interests me very much. I felt rather as if the Indians should have Hindi as their language, and the Indonesians should have Indonesia, Bahasa, whatever it's called, as their language, and that the Africans should have Swahili as their language if they wanted. But these are very separatist movements. I mean, when you get people all with their separate languages, and English is really so widespread. That I dislike more than the attitude that the English-speaking peoples are the most important or the best people in the world. This is not true at all. They aren't even the most numerous. But there are more people speaking English for a means of communication throughout the world than any other language. And one important fact, which really convinced me that this was so, was I was in an airplane down in the Caribbean 2 years ago. It was a private plane, and I was up with the fellow who was running it. And here, all these airports were giving their commands or directions, all in English, and all in very funny English, I may say, because nobody was English. They were French or Dutch or Spanish or something. But it's an international, a law of international aviation, that the instructions from the airport tower shall be given in English. Now that sort of convinces me that this is the real international language. Yeah?
Well, what are the villages like in Kashmir?
In Kashmir? Well, in a way, they're somewhat like they are in Nepal. It's a high country, except for the valley of Kashmir.
Yes.
That is low and is also all around the lake. But I went up into the mountains a little bit on horseback from Srinagar, is the capital of Kashmir. And again, we went on horseback, and pretty soon you get right up in snow. And it again begins to look sort of like Nepal or any hill country.
About how many people would live in that village? I mean, are they large villages, or are they two or three?
Well, in India, they're all. Some of them are as small as 100 people and up to 800 or 900. It's a small group in a village. Yeah?
Well, did you go to East Pakistan?
I've never been there. You know, people, I'm terribly sorry, but I'll try and tell you what I know about it. What did you want to ask? I know a little something.
Well, I want to know about the villages.
Well, they're just about exactly the same as they are in West in Bengal, which is part of India. Well, they're small-sized villages, mostly made of mud or brick. Now they're making their own brick, particularly as you've heard about the community development scheme that they have in many countries. India has really done it more extensively than any other country in the world. There are 500,000 villages in India, and every one of them has had some little assistance from what they call their community development scheme, with an added extension service. This is what the government does. And I really would like to talk about that just a minute. Before independence, you heard a lot about what Gandhi did, and what a wonderful, wonderful leader he was, and what a great nonviolent leader he was. And the main thing I think we know him for is that he managed to make his people remain nonviolent and successfully resist and throw out the British. That's the main thing we know. I think what is not quite so well known is that all the time that he kept this objective before his people, he said, in effect, he said, look, it's no good getting free and getting the British out of here if we ourselves don't improve. Our villages are dirty, they're poor, people are sick, we don't have enough schools. And many, many, many people joined Gandhi in teams. The place he lived and got people around with it was known as an ashram. You know that one, ASHRAM. And other people had ashrams in which volunteers came and worked in the surrounding villages to make the people aware of the importance of being clean. And gradually it got into schooling and health and so on. This idea, which was really Gandhi's, is the basic philosophy of what they now call community development. It just doesn't have that great, great spiritual leader, Gandhi, at its head.
It's not really so different from our Peace Corps, is it?
It's quite different in that, the Peace Corps, I think, does.
The people in it are doing more or less the same kind of thing, aren't they? Or are they bringing more to it?
Well, you're quite right. Now, down in Colombia, in the country of Colombia, the Peace Corps volunteers who have gone down there are doing exactly this. They go out by one or two into small villages, and they just live right there. I've seen one of the places outside of Bogota, Colombia, where two young American boys are, and really it is a simple. When people say the Peace Corps volunteers are living simply, they really are. And they just get to know the local priest, they get to know the local school teacher, they get to know the parents and the community and the church, and they say, well, now what do we do here? And they all say, we want a school. And so these boys, who don't know very much about construction or anything, get some help from the government in advice and materials. And the people in the village go to work and build a school. And they showed us what they'd done right there in that little village.
Is this the way it works in India? How is it different?
It isn't any different from that. That is the principle of everybody work cooperatively to get the thing that they want is the basis of all this village development. But the great thing is that you might not think it would be possible to get all the villages alive and working like this, but they are. Mm-hmm.
Donald, did you have a question?
Yes, I'd like to ask you about Punjab.
Punjab, yeah. Because that, you know, was, the Punjab is now divided between India and Pakistan. It was the scene of the most dreadful riots and murders and everything at the time of partition. You all know about partition, don't you? I mean, you know that when they were negotiating with India with England to become free, there was a separatist group of Muslims, Mohammedans, who wanted the areas that were predominantly Mohammedan to form a separate nation. And there are a great many people, and most of the Indians feel sad about this. They wish it had never happened. Anyway, Punjab.